This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Unregistered is still a completely listener-supported podcast. So, if you want to keep the show going, I need your help. To make a contribution, you can go to unregisteredlisteners.com. You'll receive access to the private Unregistered Facebook page where I discuss the ideas from the show with listeners. You'll also receive gifts of unregistered merchandise, transcripts of the interviews, autographed copies of my books, webinars on history, politics, culture, and philosophy, and a download of my 11-part video lecture course on A Renegade History of the United States. I really hope you can help me keep these remarkable conversations going. There's another way you can participate directly in conversations with me, like the ones on the podcast. There are still a few tickets left for a special weekend event with me in Salem, Massachusetts on August 5th and 6th. You can get all the information for the event at thaddeusrussell.com/courses/weekend. This week's guest is me, and the interviewer is you. This week, in the first Ask Me Anything episode of Unregistered, I answer questions submitted by listeners. I address postmodernism, Freud's theory of civilization, the controversy over Confederate monuments, the meaning of video games, and the history of violence. I hope you like it. I received several questions about postmodernism, so bear with me while I go through this, because I know that some of you are quite irritated by this topic, and it is my mission in life to make everybody care about it. So Kevin B. says, "You are the first person to speak positively about postmodernism and relativism in a way that makes me not want to punch them, notwithstanding the fact you would punch me back harder," he says. "I'm really coming around to the idea that an agreement on no truth leads ultimately to no authority for people to use over others." Now, this makes me very, very happy, not just because Kevin doesn't want to punch me, but because he summarizes sort of the big political idea that I have about postmodernism, which is that it undercuts truth claims, which are always in the service of authority and power over other people. But then he says, "However, I deeply believe there is an objective reality. Is it possible to consider oneself a postmodernist for political purposes while adhering to a belief in objective reality personally?" And so what I would say to Kevin and anyone who has that question is, sure, you can believe in an objective reality personally and not politically, but to me that's a contradiction. Now, what you can do though is separate different realms of discourse, different realms of knowledge, and this might make it easier though. I still think it's a contradiction, but many people do the following. They separate off the physical world and truth claims about the physical world from claims about morality. So you can say, "I believe that this is a table, that's an airplane, that gravity operates in the following ways, etc." And reject absolute moral claims, claims that there are certain things that are good for all people at all times. That's a moral claim, by the way. It's the claim that something is universally good, that it's good in all places at all times and forever. Now, there is not a single political movement that I'm aware of in the modern age that does not rely upon absolute moral claims. Conservatism says that the nuclear family is always good for all people. Socialists say a collective economy is always good for all people and always will be. Many or most libertarians say that a free market economy is the best for most people at all times, everywhere. And so by denaturalizing those claims, by saying, what is the basis for that? Because there is no logical argument for them. They really are articles of faith. There is a leap there that these political movements make and political actors make when they make moral claims. You can certainly make a utilitarian argument for those things. You could say that a national health service will provide more healthcare to more people. I mean, we can just test that empirically. That's fine. But they go further than that, right? They say it's a moral good. It is a good to have a collectivized economy. And conversely, they say it's an evil to have a market economy. There is no way to prove that. It is simply an article of faith. It is no different to me than making a claim that God exists or that God is good or that God's rules are good. So I do think that if you want to always be skeptical and always want to be outside of authority and always want to keep authority on its heels, you want to adopt this position, at least, of moral relativism. We can talk about the physical world later, but I do think that it's really essential for human liberty, really, to keep that position that there is no such thing as an absolute good. Now, of course, I have a lot more to say on postmodernism, and what I want to do is hold a webinar for Renegade University later this summer on this very subject. And what we will do in that webinar is do something that most people who talk about postmodernism seem to not do, which is to actually read the texts. We will actually read Foucault and read Derrida and read some other postmodernist theorists and decide for ourselves what they are actually saying. One of the great frustrations I've had in recent months is the great number of people in the public sphere who very freely denounce postmodernism and pretty clearly haven't read much of postmodernism, if any. What they say about people like Foucault bears almost no resemblance to my own reading of Foucault. Now, because I'm a postmodernist, I don't believe there is any such thing as a true or accurate interpretation of a text, but I can say this, that most of the people who criticize postmodernism and blame it for many of society's ills these days, that their interpretation of those texts of Foucault and Derrida and others bears no resemblance or little resemblance to most scholars who do read them. That interpretation of them is certainly at odds with my own interpretation, especially of Foucault. So this brings me to the next question, which is from Shay T. Shay says, I want to hear more about your views on postmodernism and why you think Jordan Peterson is misunderstanding its philosophy. So many of you probably know that Jordan Peterson is one of these people who, in the public sphere in the last several months, has denounced postmodernism and has offered his own interpretations of it. Now, I do have a lot of respect for Jordan Peterson for many things, and I don't think he's entirely wrong about postmodernism. Again, I don't think there is any such thing as an entirely wrong interpretation of a text, but I do think his interpretation is certainly contradicts mine and contradicts, I would think, most people's interpretations of Foucault and Derrida, at least people who've read those texts. In response to this, I've done a couple of things. First of all, I have invited Jordan Peterson to be a guest on the Unregistered podcast. I invited him about a month ago, and I have not yet heard back from him. Now, I am not accusing him of dodging me. I understand that he is a very busy man, but the invitation stands. Second, about a month ago, I was asked by the Soho Forum to propose a topic and an opponent for me to debate at the Soho Forum in New York City. So today, I just sent an email to the head of the Soho Forum proposing that I debate Jordan Peterson on the topic of postmodernism. I hope to hear back from them soon. I hope this happens, and I hope to see you there if it does happen. I received a different and very good question about postmodernism, and this is from Josh M. He says that in episode 7 with Anna Arrowsmith, the two of you discuss an idea of Foucault's that I absolutely love and am dying to read more on, but I can't find in any text. Around the 18-minute mark in discussing Andrea Dworkin's sexualized campaign against pornography, Anna Arrowsmith says, like Foucault would say, it's a sexualized experience fighting porn. You then elaborate on that idea and say that you think he calls it something like the pleasure of the chase. That idea, says Josh, that chasing after immorality and the immorality itself are just two sides of the same coin seems so spot on to me. it seems especially explanatory in today's political climate, in which nearly all sides seem far more excited to accuse the other of some evil or immorality, like racism, fascism, misogyny, treasonous anti-Americanism, etc., and impugn their motives than they do to criticize the other side's proposals and ideas. But I think more generally, it explains the less than stellar motives of those we think of as do-gooders, who perhaps just sublimate their own desires into persecuting those who fulfill them. The example that keeps coming to mind is the prosecutor who pathologically hunts criminals. Could you point me in the direction of Foucault's writing where he discusses this, or even some secondary commentary on it? Now, this is such a great question that I have to respond for many reasons. One is that it's a very important point in Foucault that I use quite often in my own work and in my politics. And I also want to make sure that people understand where this is coming from. It's very important to me that we, as I said earlier, go to the text when there's any question like this about what people have actually written. So let me tell you where this is in Foucault's writing. It is in his History of Sexuality, Volume 1, which is a text that I have been teaching for about 20 years. On page 45 in the History of Sexuality, Volume 1, Foucault says the following, and he's referring to the growth of the medical profession in the 19th century and the way in which they pathologized certain things like homosexuality or women's nervous disorders. And he identified a pleasure in the investigation or examination and pathologizing by the medical professionals of these people. Foucault says on page 45, "The medical examination, the psychiatric investigation, the pedagogical report, and family controls may have the overall and apparent objective of saying no to all wayward or unproductive sexualities, but the fact is that they function as mechanisms with a double impetus, pleasure and power. The pleasure that comes of exercising a power that questions, monitors, watches, spies, searches out, palpates, brings to light, and on the other hand, the pleasure that kindles at having to evade this power, flee from it, fool it, or travesty it. The power that lets itself be invaded by the pleasure it is pursuing, and opposite it, power asserting itself in the pleasure of showing off, scandalizing, or resisting. Capture and seduction, confrontation and mutual reinforcement, parents and children, adults and adolescents, educator and students, doctors and patients, the psychiatrist with his hysteric and his perverts, all have played this game continually since the 19th century. These attractions, these evasions, these circular incitements have traced around bodies and sexes, not boundaries to be crossed, but perpetual spirals of power and pleasure." So one of the first things that Foucault is doing here is he is taking on Freud's repressive hypothesis, this idea that repression, and this, of course, is central in my work, so this actually challenges my own ideas, even though I am a great fan of Foucault and very much influenced by him. Freud's idea was that civilization requires the repression of sexual impulses, what he calls the id, the animalistic urges in the body, that it requires us to either do away with those desires entirely, to rid them, to repress them entirely, or to make them into something else, to sublimate them, that's his word, to channel things like desire for sex or desire to kill into work, in particular productive work, that civilization requires this process of sublimation. And he says that's not actually true. There is no removal of these desires, Foucault says. There is simply an addition of desires. There's the creation of new desires when civilization attempts to repress. So when, in the 19th century, he says, the psychiatric profession was invented and psychiatrists began to examine people and tell them and tell the world through their medical journals that certain behaviors were pathological or unnatural and had to be done away with, like homosexuality, they weren't actually removing homosexuality or even homosexual desire from civilization, Foucault says. He's arguing that what they did was, in fact, they put homosexuality into society. They put it into discourse. They made it a thing, a category. In fact, as we know, the term homosexuality did not exist in the West or anywhere in the world until the late 19th century. It was invented by a German medical professional in the 1870s, and then became a term used in Europe and the United States, it did not appear in English language dictionaries until the middle of the 20th century. And on top of that, Foucault says that once this category is created, like homosexuality or pedophilia, which was also invented during this period, people begin to identify with it. And so you don't see homosexual subcultures, you don't see an identifiable homosexual culture of any kind anywhere in the world until then. Homosexuals start to call themselves that. It becomes its own category with its own characteristics. Homosexuals are defined in particular ways. Homosexuals do this, they think this way, they act in these ways, etc. And then we see people in Paris and London and New York City during this period, after the invention of the term by the medical establishment in order to rid the world of these evil things, you see these people identifying as homosexuals and doing things that they identify as homosexual. So what Foucault is saying is that power, the exercise of power, even when it is trying to repress or remove things from the world, ends up simply creating new things, new desires, new forms of discourse, new ways of thinking, new categories. It is never reductive, he says. It is always productive. When power is exercised to eliminate something, it does just the opposite. It creates something new. And Foucault says that in the process of attacking or chasing these new evils, these new pathologies, these new dangers or threats to civilization, he's saying that what drives that process is a desire, a sexualized desire within the psychiatrist or the medical professional or the prosecutor or the police officer, a sexual desire, which I would say sounds sort of like sadism, although Foucault doesn't actually use that term, but it is a form of sadism, I would think. There is a pleasure one derives from going after the evil, from attacking the evil, from attacking the devil. And Foucault suggests that it is an erotic desire, and I think he's onto something there. It really helps explain the tremendous amount of energy that civilizations have expended on identifying, chasing, persecuting, prosecuting, imprisoning, killing people who do things you're not supposed to do in a society. And there's an even more provocative claim that Foucault is making here, which is that there's a pleasure as well in avoiding the chase, in evading power, in running from the cops, in breaking the law, in refusing to answer the psychiatrist's intrusive questions, in playing hooky from school, in violating all of the rules of society. He says there is an erotic pleasure as well. And so this is one of the many ways in which Foucault challenges or really repudiates left-wing politics. Left-wing politics, of course, says that there are oppressors who have all or most of the power and victims, the oppressed at the bottom of society, that all of power runs from top to bottom. Foucault says just the opposite in the history of sexuality. In fact, he has a whole section on page 94 in which he totally contradicts the politics on campuses today, the politics of what we call the social justice warriors, the politics of what Jordan Peterson identifies as originating in postmodernism. And this is why I'm so flummoxed by what Peterson says about it. On page 94 of The History of Sexuality, Foucault says, power comes from below. That is, there is no binary and all-encompassing opposition between rulers and ruled at the root of power relations and serving as a general matrix. There is no such duality extending from the top down and reacting on more and more limited groups to the very depths of the social body. One must suppose, rather, Foucault says, that the manifold relationships of force that take shape and come into play in the machinery of production, in families, limited groups, and institutions are the basis for wide-ranging effects of cleavage that run through the social body as a whole. What he says in the rest of the book and elsewhere is that everyone in a civilization holds power, participates in power, distributes power, keeps others in check, keeps themselves in check. There is no simple binary between the master class who control everything and who determine history and the victimless oppressed who have no agency. In fact, one of Foucault's major claims that is so important in the way that I read history and talk about history is that he grants agency to everyone. To the slaves, to the poorest, to the immigrants, to the workers, to the women, to the blacks, to everyone. He says that civilization is a product of all who participate in it, that power is widely distributed and participated in by all. Those who are victims, he argues, I think in effect, have chosen to become victims. They have chosen to identify as victims. It wasn't forced upon them. He also says that there are those who are at the lowest levels of society who are not victims, nor are they participants in civilization. He calls them the people who remain in the shade. They remain outside of power. They are those who are not observed, those who are not surveilled, those who are outside the realm of power, people who refuse to participate, people who look to me, in his description of them, like the renegades in my book, those who are outside of society and have no interest in being part of society. But as I said, I'll go into all of this in much greater detail in the webinar for Renegade University coming this late summer or early fall, and hopefully in a debate with Jordan Peterson in public. Yeah, I consider myself to be a scholar of popular culture. I think popular culture is very important. Obviously, it's at the center of Renegade History of the United States. It's at the center of all of my work. I think it is understudied, actually, in academia. But one of the things in popular culture now that is so important that I've never talked about, never written about, is video games. And two listeners actually brought this up, Sam D. and Noah W., and they said, why don't you talk about gaming ever? And they're right, I should talk about gaming. I don't have that much thought out in terms of an analysis of gaming and its place in our culture and its effects. Partly because I'm not a gamer, I don't participate in that world, and I don't know that much about it. I know some. I gamed a little bit about 15 years ago, but games have changed so much since then that I don't feel competent to comment on what the games are like now. My son has played some games, and I've observed that as well. But here's some things I do think, I do notice. Clearly, violence is at the center of most of the popular games, and it's a kind of violence that disturbs sort of the keepers of morality. We're constantly hearing about how violence in video games is degrading the consciousness of our youth and making them possibly more violent and perhaps creating serial killers, et cetera. And that's been debunked sort of empirically by a number of studies that have shown that it actually does not contribute to violence and has no relationship to, you know, murder rates, et cetera. But I think there's something more interesting going on with video games and violence, which is that it's a kind of violence that is not allowed. So one of the things that was repressed in the 19th century, in addition to sex and sexuality, was violence, a particular kind of violence. Now, of course, the violence that we see in wars, military violence, and the violence we see conducted by the police and the state, those, of course, were legitimated in the 19th century and the 20th century. And those have never been delegitimated, really, in our society. Max Weber, the great sociologist in the early 20th century, called that the state monopoly on violence, or the monopoly on legitimate violence. And his argument was that the state holds the monopoly on the legitimate use of violence, that there is a cultural consensus that no one can use violence without the state authorizing it. So what was banned or made forbidden in the 19th century was random, spontaneous acts of violence, mostly by the working class, sort of in the streets, like street fights, bar fights. Boxing was shunned for quite a while. MMA, more recently, has faced the same sort of wrath because it was seen as this kind of anarchic violence that was forbidden in the 19th century. Part of what we call bourgeois repression was this repression of violence. And Freud talked about it, talked about how the id was made up of two things, sexual desire and the desire for violence, as I mentioned earlier. And you'll see in the writings and the lectures and the sermons and the speeches and the editorials and the textbooks of the 19th century by the moral reformers of the time, this incessant demand that people stop taking action on their own to rectify wrongs, to seek justice, that they needed to look to the state, to the police, and to the military to find justice. So I think what we're seeing, maybe, is what Freud called, and here I am using Freud after talking about Foucault for so long, and in fact they were in at odds with one another, but I am sort of a Freudian, I can't help it in some ways. We're seeing, I think, in video games what Freud called the return of the repressed. He said that those desires of the id for sex and violence will be repressed for a time by civilization, or they may be sublimated for a time, that people may be forced in various ways to channel their energies for those things into productive work and to being good citizens, but eventually they will come back as something bigger and worse and scarier. I think that might be part of what's going on with video games. Clearly, a lot of, you know, a huge portion of the population who is keenly interested in enacting that kind of violence. It's a virtual violence. It's not an actual physical violence. But I think it needs to be looked at in that way. It's interesting that there is no apparent relationship between actual physical violence and the playing of video games. But I think there is quite a lot of psychic violence that's being played out in video games. And I think that is not entirely unhealthy. There is an anger, there is a rage that we feel, all of us, I think, every day, that we are not allowed to express in this society. That's part of the repression. And I think that's what you get to do in a video game. You get to actually enact in that way that anger, that rage, that desire for vengeance, that desire for justice, that desire to punch somebody in the face or shoot somebody in the head, which we all have, and we have to admit that. We're not even allowed to admit that we have those desires. And particularly boys are not allowed to admit that they have those desires. Those things are constantly repressed, and I think that's what video games allow us to express. I think video games are equivalent to pornography also. Pornography allows us to express or demonstrate or gratify our desires for sexual pleasures that are forbidden in our society. I think they both serve as very useful sociological documents in that way. I have said for a long time that pornography is essentially the record of the collective unconscious of our society. It's a remarkable document, and it is equally remarkable that academics rarely study it. In fact, there is virtually no study of pornography among academics. There's virtually no study of video games among academics. Sure, there are a few outposts here and there that do it in universities, but it is, I would say, less than 1% of sociologists and anthropologists and political scientists and historians and cultural critics and American studies scholars study either one. It's something that needs to be changed if we want to be serious about understanding what's really going on inside and underneath our society. And finally, a very good question about my specialty, U.S. history. This is from Mike S. Mike says, as a historian, what do you think about the removal of the Confederate monuments in New Orleans? In your opinion, is there a litmus test when it comes to the type of memorials that get taken down and the ones that are allowed to remain? Also, do you see a difference between a Vietnam War memorial versus an Iraq War memorial? So I have a few things to say about this. The first is that when the statue started coming down a couple of years ago, when Woodrow Wilson was targeted at Princeton, I said, well, if we're going to take down the statues of all the racists and imperialists in this country, we need to go straight to the FDR Memorial in Washington, D.C. and take that down. We really wouldn't be able to stop. I mean, none of the statues would be left if we took down statues of all the racists and imperialists and bad people in history. And, you know, I'm actually not opposed to that because these are state publicly funded statues. They are foisting these people into our faces largely without our choice. Only those of us who support those people and voted for those who decided to have those statues, you know, had a choice there. I certainly had no choice in having Woodrow Wilson or FDR or Confederates in my face every day. So I think it is perfectly fine to tear them down. I also think it is somewhat lazy to tear them down rather than to engage with the history that they represent. I'd much rather spend our energy studying what Woodrow Wilson said and did, what the Confederate generals said and did. I'd much rather study the history of racism, the history of imperialism, than simply remove them from our vision. In fact, that is the problem. I want those things to be in our vision. This is what I don't like about the removal of the word nigger from our vocabulary. It is one of the most important words in American history. If we do not discuss that word, if we cannot use that word, we will not be able to understand our history in any serious way. Rather than remove Confederates from our view, we need to study the Confederates. We need to study slavery. This is another thing that bedevils me every single day. Everyone in America apparently is born an expert on slavery and the Old South, when in fact, virtually no one knows anything about it, but they are free to express their opinions. Two historians who are experts on it, who have spent their lives studying those subjects. If you say anything that is contrary to the Hollywood version of the Confederacy or slavery, we all know this, you can lose your job. You will certainly lose your standing in society. You will be considered a racist immediately. You will be tarnished forever. So what I would much rather we do than remove these things from our vocabularies, from our vision, from our sight, is to study them, to think about them. Again, let's go to the text. And let's think harder. I want to thank everyone who sent in questions. I got so many fantastic questions, and I'm sorry I couldn't address them all. One of the things I learned from this is that I think I have the smartest listeners of all the podcasts in the world right now. Really impressive. I am quite gratified by that. I'm glad to know that I have such an intelligent audience, and I'm looking forward to doing this again. Maybe next time I'll be talking to listeners directly and answering their questions live. This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. Please don't forget to check out unregisteredlisteners.com to support the show. And if you're interested in the special weekend event in Salem, Massachusetts, go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses/weekend. Thanks for listening.